publishing house, which was staggering under heavy debts. The two men who had met on a yacht 2 years before were both legendary raconteurs and wits and developed an instant rapport. Rogers decided to mount a rescue effort, and the next morning wrote out a check for $8,000. Taking Twain's finances in hand, he kept Twain's creditors at bay and rallied his spirits, inviting him along with Archbold to prize fights at the New York Athletic Club. With canny foresight, Rogers insisted that Twain retain all his copyrights, a service which saved me and my family from want and assured us permanent comfort and prosperity, Twain said later. Under Rogers's tutelage, Twain invested his royalties wisely and paid off his debts. Awash with gratitude, Twain refused to publish Henry Demarest Lloyd's Wealth Against Commonwealth. A friend of infinite tact, Rogers endeared himself to Twain as much by the manner as the substance of what he did. By no sign, no hint, no word did he ever betray any consciousness that I was under obligations to him, Twain wrote. I have never been so great as that, and I have not known another who was. Their friendship survived Twain's financial crisis, and Rogers later negotiated lucrative book contracts for Twain, who became a frequent guest aboard Rogers's steam yacht, the Kanawha. During one cruise, Twain composed his sketch, The Loaves and the Fishes, in which he argued that the true miracle of the biblical story was not the multiplication of bread and fishes, but the 12 disciples served 5,000 people and lived to tell the tale. When Rogers was devastated by Lawson's vitriolic portrait in Frenzied Finance, Twain supplied favorable anecdotes about him for a profile in The World's Work, a magazine published by Frank Doubleday. For Rogers, Twain reserved his highest encomium. He is not only the best friend I have ever had, but is the best man I have known. A frequent visitor to 26 Broadway, Twain loved to smoke cigars, read, and lounge on the sofa in Rogers's office, while his friend entertained a steady stream of visitors. He had no concerns about Rogers's reputation. "He's a pirate, all right," Twain said, "but he owns up to it and enjoys being a pirate. That's the reason I like him." For a time, Twain turned 26 Broadway into his downtown clubhouse and sometimes lunched with Junior. "I got down here to the Standard Oil in time for late luncheon with young Rockefeller. It is the best homemade table in the North," Twain once told his wife. He formed a favorable opinion of Junior as a plain, simple, earnest, sincere, honest, well-meaning, commonplace person, destitute of originality or any suggestion of it. A defender to the end, Twain later blamed the muckrakers and Teddy Roosevelt for Standard Oil's infamy. That the trust had scarcely had a strike in more than four decades proved to him that the Standard Oil chiefs cannot be altogether bad, or they would oppress their 65,000 employees from habit and instinct, if they are so constituted that it is instinctive with them to oppress everybody else. Another perceptive author developed intense affection for Rogers. In 1896, the 16-year-old Helen Keller, who was blind and deaf, met him and Twain at a gathering to raise money for her future education. Even before the meeting, Twain laid the groundwork, telling Mrs. Rogers, "It won't do for America to allow this marvelous child to retire from her studies because of poverty." Rogers paid for much of Helen Keller's education at Radcliffe College, which she gratefully acknowledged. "That I haven't missed my small part of usefulness in the world, I owe to Mr. Clemens and Mr. Rogers," she wrote. After graduating cum laude, Helen stayed in touch with Rogers and poignantly dedicated her book, The World I Live In, to "my dear friend of many years." Before he died, Rogers established an annuity that gave her lifelong security. Helen Keller's teacher, Ann Sullivan, later revealed that "Mr. Rockefeller, Jr., and his father have been interested in Helen most of her life." Unlike the help from Rogers, the Rockefeller money was given anonymously. In the 1890s, Rockefeller stumbled, almost by accident, into owning most of the iron ore on the Mesabi Range, the last business project that he executed on a monumental scale. This legendary investment began as another blunder bequeathed by his bumbling former advisers Colby and Hoyt. When Gates first examined the iron ore properties the two had bought in Cuba, Michigan, and Wisconsin, he thought they were worthless holes. Colby and Hoyt had, however, unearthed one promising entity, the Minnesota Iron Company. Gates was impressed on a westward journey by the potential of the Mesabi Range, which contained a broad band of iron ore laid across a 120-mile strip in northern Minnesota. Though it held out hope of being the richest such vein ever found in North America, its commercial utility had not been demonstrated. Unlike hard rock dug from underground mines and fed into blast furnaces, the Mesabi ore was fine, powdery stuff that either clogged furnaces or blew out their chimneys, scattering dust across the countryside. On the other hand, it lay close to the surface and in such abundance that it could be scooped out by steam shovels at a fraction of the expense of underground mines. Among the pioneers in Mesabi ore were the Backwoods Merritt family. These so-called seven men of iron, four brothers and three nephews, borrowed recklessly, snapped up tremendous tracts of land, then launched construction of a railroad to carry the ore to Lake Superior. When the 1893 panic savaged iron prices, however, they faced a severe cash squeeze. The atmosphere in Duluth grew incendiary as workers with drawn pistols forced their way into the office of the Merritts Railroad to demand payment of overdue wages. In rescuing the Merritts, Rockefeller reenacted his old pattern of swooping down, fortified with cash, on distressed properties and seizing a commanding position. As with the malodorous Lima oil, he wagered that the Mesabi ore would someday be of value. Even as Andrew Carnegie and his experts gleefully scoffed at this preposterous idea. As Carnegie's right-hand man, Charles Schwab, said of these naysayers, they couldn't understand how Rockefeller, without knowledge of the iron business, could invest money in ores that were useless, at least for a long time to come, to which Rockefeller retorted tersely, "It was a surprise to me that the great iron and steel manufacturers did not place what seemed to be an adequate value on these mines." He believed that, like the early days in oil, the steel industry was on the verge of overproduction and would soon fall prey to suicidal competition unless stabilized by strong owners. An expert in the strategic importance of transportation, he avidly eyed the extensive rail and dock facilities controlled by the Merritts. When Rockefeller advanced money to the Merritts in the panic summer of 1893, he was one of the few people who could have saved them. Naively, he expected to disburse a modest $100,000, and he never imagined that the Mesabi project would tax his colossal resources and consume 8 years of his time. In exchange for his investment, Rockefeller negotiated a deal with the Merritts to set up a holding company, the Lake Superior Consolidated Iron Mines, which would combine the Merritts rail and mining assets and the rather mediocre mining properties cobbled together by Colby and Hoyt. The idea was that the Merritts would run the company and employ Rockefeller's cash infusion to finish the stalled railroad. At first, Rockefeller owned only a fifth of the stock, but he exercised final control through his first mortgage bonds, which enjoyed a lien on the entire company in the event of a default. Given their intertwined fates, it seems odd that Rockefeller met the head of the Minnesota family, Leonidas Merritt, on only a single occasion, and then briefly in June 1893. Gates tried to shield Rockefeller from such contacts, but Merritt warmly insisted that he wished to shake his savior's hand. When they met at 26 Broadway, the meeting lasted 5 minutes, and Rockefeller was the pattern of affability. He touted the virtues of the Mesabi venture, then turned to the Minnesota weather. After a few more pleasantries, he politely excused himself and never saw any of the Merritts again. Afterward, Gates made it clear that his boss would now withdraw behind his customary screen. "In talking to me," he told Leonidas Merritt, "you are talking to Mr. Rockefeller." Even by his own extremely reclusive standards, Rockefeller was remarkably aloof during his 8-year fling in the iron business. Though he became chief landlord of the Mesabi Range, he set foot on its slopes only once, and that was long after he had disposed of his properties. In the autumn, Rockefeller's goodwill toward the Merritts ebbed. As their notes matured, they frantically pressed Gates for cash, and Rockefeller reluctantly obliged them with loans. Gates matured as a businessman during this crisis, and Rockefeller bestowed exceptional authority on him. When Gates visited Duluth in September, Rockefeller confided to SETI, "Gates reports progress daily and has $100,000 in his pocket to use at his discretion." By October, the initial loan had burgeoned to nearly $2 million, with no guarantee that the Mesabi ore would ever demonstrate commercial value. It all seemed a gamble gone hideously wrong. Pacing the Forest Hill porches, Rockefeller later remembered the harrowing, sometimes daily emergencies forced upon him by the uncouth Merritts, who kept their securities stuffed in their pockets. "I had to loan my personal securities to raise money, and finally we were compelled to supply a great deal of actual cash. And to get it, we were obliged to go into the then greatly upset money market and buy currency at a high premium and ship west by express to pay the laborers and the railroad and to keep them alive." In early 1894, still burdened by debt, the Merritts were forced to offer Rockefeller 90,000 shares of Consolidated stock at $10 a share. As with Standard Oil, Rockefeller kept adding to his Consolidated holdings, the $10 price being on a par with his other purchases at the time. The Merritts, though, vociferously claimed they had been swindled. A year later, they had to forfeit to Rockefeller an option on another 55,000 shares of Consolidated stock, surrendering to him complete control of the company. With full-throated passion, Gates urged Rockefeller to expand his investment. "It is, in my opinion, the opportunity of a lifetime. One of those opportunities, the seizing or failing to seize, which marks the difference between success and failure in life." During the next few years, as steelmakers found ways to adapt their furnaces to the bargain-priced Mesabi ore, Consolidated stock rose to stratospheric heights. In a paroxysm of frustrated rage, the Merritts demonized the man they had earlier heralded as their savior. In a rancorous suit filed against Rockefeller in Federal Circuit Court in Duluth, they portrayed themselves as innocent lumberjacks fleeced by the Eastern mogul. Fearing a biased local jury, Rockefeller retained a Minnesota newspaper man to counteract local hostility toward him, and even stepped up his Baptist missionary donations in the state. As Rockefeller feared, the Duluth jury reached a verdict in favor of the Merritts, although it was overturned on appeal. The whole feud was finally settled out of court. Rockefeller paid $525,000 to the Merritts, who publicly retracted their charges. Of this settlement, Rockefeller commented sarcastically, "We settled, paid money rather than submit to larger robbery by the 12 just and good men, as we could not get to a higher court." Stung by the controversy, Gates was still defending his behavior almost 20 years later in a short polemical pamphlet, "The Truth About Mr. Rockefeller and the Merritts," which he mailed out gratis to 10,000 people. While Rockefeller and Gates were irked by the Merritts' ingratitude, they were not entirely blameless. The Merritts alleged that Rockefeller had inflated the value of the mining properties he contributed to Consolidated, a charge that seems substantiated by Gates' own papers. In early 1893, he had written two letters to Frank Rockefeller, expressing shock at the high prices Colby and Hoyt had paid for the mines. He summed up their value as follows: "Whatever induced Colby, Hoyt and Company to form syndicates to pay such enormous figures for these worthless properties, I cannot understand. I mean to keep pegging along at it from time to time until the whole thing comes out." Having acquired several million tons of iron ore and a railroad to cart it off, Rockefeller was now stymied by a group of Lake Superior shippers who would lease him vessels only at extortionate rates. To end the deadlock, Rockefeller again recruited a talented man from the enemy ranks, Samuel Mather of Cleveland, a son-in-law of Amasa Stone. on one of those historic occasions when the curtain parted fleetingly to reveal the wizard working the levers, Rockefeller held a cordial 10-minute pre-dinner chat with Mather at West 54th Street. The visitor left with a $3 million order to build 12 ore-carrying ships, steel monsters that would surpass in size anything ever floated on the Great Lakes. After shaking hands with Rockefeller, Mather never saw him again. Given the large number of ships that he had to build, Mather figured that the shipyards would gang up and gouge him. So he pretended that he needed only one or two. After the contractors submitted their bids, they were stunned to discover that they all had contracts. The operation of this fleet required another engineering feat, the creation of specially constructed docks on Lake Superior, with long railroad trestles extending hundreds of feet into the water. As the lake's shipping cartel watched in consternation, the Rockefeller operation began to load ore at the stupefying rate of 10,000 tons every 6 hours. Where the schooners had charged $4.20 a ton, Rockefeller's operators carried their mineral cargo at a cost of 80 cents a ton. When Mather declined to manage the fleet, Rockefeller asked Gates to suggest an experienced firm to pilot the ships. "No," said Gates, increasingly showing flashes of a quirky independence. "I do not know of any firm to suggest at the moment, but why not run them ourselves?" Taken aback, Rockefeller replied, "You don't know anything about ships, do you?" Gates confessed not, but nominated his uncle Lamont Montgomery Bowers as a candidate. "He lives up the state and never was on a ship in his life. He probably wouldn't know the bow from the stern or a sea anchor from an umbrella, but he has good sense, he is honest, enterprising, keen, and thrifty." Having often hired people based on general ability, not specific skills, Gates himself being a prime example, Rockefeller acceded to the choice. Bald and well-tailored, Bowers had an extensive business resume, ranging from selling soap to running a real estate agency in Omaha, to selling groceries in upstate New York. Much to Rockefeller's delight, he not only ably commanded, but considerably expanded the fleet. Mostly under the aegis of the Cleveland-based Bessemer Steamship Company, Rockefeller acquired 56 steel vessels, the largest fleet on the Great Lakes, and the world's biggest assemblage of ore carriers. His position in lake shipping was so unassailable that he could dictate rates on Lake Superior, much as they had been dictated to him a few years earlier, a situation that galvanized Andrew Carnegie into organizing the competing Pittsburgh Steamship Company. Tutored by Gates in the eccentric ways of Mr. Rockefeller, Bowers was told that he must not, under any circumstances, communicate with the boss. Rockefeller never saw the vast majority of ships in his armada. One day, however, Rockefeller dropped by unexpectedly to consult him on a shipping matter, prompting a humorous exchange. "You are making me break the orders I have from your own office, Mr. Rockefeller," Bowers reminded him. "Oh, Mr. Bowers, I am getting along in years," Rockefeller replied in his droll Midwestern manner. "I think I may really be allowed a little liberty by my office." Bowers's success in managing the fleet was perhaps unfortunate, for it led directly to his later assignment to a Rockefeller-controlled mining venture in the Rocky Mountains, called Colorado Fuel and Iron, where he would bring lasting disgrace to the Rockefeller name. Rockefeller's success on the Mesabi Range precipitated a clash between America's two wealthiest individuals, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. In their approach to business, the two men had often mirrored each other, stressing attention to detail, ruthlessly slashing costs, and keeping dividends low. Both had struggled with their own unacknowledged avarice, pioneered in philanthropy, and prided themselves on being friends of the working man. Yet they never seemed to get along. Each Christmas they perfunctorily exchanged gifts, Rockefeller giving Carnegie a paper vest, while Carnegie sent the teetotaler excellent whiskey. In letters to his colleagues, Carnegie often struck a jeering tone toward Rockefeller, refusing to concede his business acumen, and he suffered under the misapprehension that Rockefeller had conspired with Standard Oil colleagues in the Mesabi venture. Upon first hearing of his pact with the Merritts, Carnegie lectured his steel company board, Remember, Rockefellers and Porter will own the railroad, and that's like owning the pipelines. Producers will not have much of a show. I don't think standard people will succeed in making ore a monopoly like oil. They have failed in every new venture, and Rockefeller's reputation now is one of the poorest investors in the world. Much too patronizing toward Rockefeller, Carnegie had seriously misjudged developments in the ore business. Having moved decisively to control coke and coal supplies, he assumed that ore would always remain cheap and plentiful, and flatly told colleagues that their brilliant and talented young partners should stay clear of that business. When a colorful Pittsburgh promoter, Henry Oliver, tried to interest Carnegie in a joint venture with the Merritts, he responded with a tongue-lashing. "If there is any department of business which offers no inducement, it is ore." Luckily, Carnegie's subordinates overruled him and took a stake in the Mesabi ore. As a result, Carnegie Steel was not entirely excluded from the rush to secure properties in northern Minnesota. Having failed to move aggressively, Carnegie looked on impotently as Rockefeller applied to iron ore lessons he had learned in oil, such as controlling an industry through transportation and demoralizing competitors with prices too low for them to match. Two industry trends finally compelled Carnegie to broker a deal with Rockefeller. As mergers consolidated the steel industry, it became essential to pin down sure sources of supply. And as new furnaces were equipped to use the dirt-cheap Mesabi ore, it developed into the industry standard. By 1896, the press buzzed with speculation that Rockefeller would build a huge steel mill in Cleveland or South Chicago, forge a steel trust on the Standard Oil model, and go head-to-head with Andrew Carnegie. Meanwhile, Rockefeller poured another $19 million into the Mesabi range to buttress his railroad and shipping operations. It vexed Carnegie that Rockefeller, an oil man, had possessed such superior foresight in the iron ore business. In his private correspondence, he vented his frustration in petty digs, referring to him derisively as Rockefeller, and later on as Rockefeller. In December 1896, a humbled Carnegie at last consented to a sweeping deal. He promised to consume the entire output of Rockefeller's chief mines, a minimum of 600,000 tons of ore, at the rock-bottom royalty rate of 25 cents a ton. In exchange for this steep discount, however, Carnegie agreed to ship the entire amount, plus another 600,000 tons from his own mines, over Rockefeller's railroads and on his vessels. It was the same kind of back-scratching arrangement that Rockefeller had negotiated with the railroads to monopolize the oil industry. To complete their truce, Carnegie pledged to refrain from buying new Mesabi fields or transporting iron ore, while Rockefeller renounced any ambition to construct a steel mill. A generation later, Carnegie still boasted of this deal before a Senate committee. "Don't you know it does my heart good to think I got ahead of John D. Rockefeller on a bargain?" In fact, the bargain had been Carnegie's belated attempt to redress his own error. Small competitors found it impossible to survive the union of the largest producer and largest consumer of iron ore, and Carnegie and Rockefeller profited smartly. As with oil, ore prices skidded lower, bankrupting marginal producers and bolstering the Rockefeller-Carnegie alliance. As the decade closed, ferocious competition broke out for the remaining Mesabi properties. The price of Lake Superior consolidated stock that Rockefeller had bought for $10 in 1894 levitated to $60 in 1899, $70 in 1900, then a staggering $100 in 1901. America now stood on the threshold of an era of economic consolidation that saw trusts spread to many industries. What Rockefeller had accomplished in oil a generation earlier was now being imitated in steel, copper, rubber, tobacco, leather, and other products, much to the alarm of many voters. The ideological lines were drawn sharply in the 1896 presidential election. The Democratic candidate, William Jennings Bryan, an eloquent orator adored by socialists, populists, and silverites, vied with former Ohio Governor William McKinley, a staunch advocate of tariffs, trusts, and hard currency. Apprehensive about a Bryan presidency, businessmen transformed the McKinley campaign into a crusade against trust-busting infidels. Standard Oil supplied $250,000 to McKinley's coffers, equal to half of the total Democratic contributions, and Rockefeller sent another $2,500 to campaign manager Mark Hanna. For a man normally scornful of politicians, Rockefeller displayed unusual passion for McKinley, asserting, "I can see nothing else for us to do to serve the country and our honor." The business community reacted to the McKinley victory as if America had been blessedly spared a revolution, a mood summed up in Hanna's congratulatory telegram to McKinley. "God's in his heaven, all's right with the world." During the next few years, a new faith arose in business circles about the inevitability and unrivaled efficiency of monopolies. Mark Hanna, now tagged Dollar Mark by the press, proclaimed loudly that the Sherman Antitrust Act would never be allowed to thwart this trend in a Republican administration. Stimulated by the Spanish-American War, the Klondike Gold Strike, and McKinley's reassuring presence, the American economy surged ahead in the late 1890s, propelling the United States past all other nations in industrial capacity. In a country that still liked to picture itself as composed of small businesses, huge companies now blanketed markets from coast to coast. As satirist Finley Peter Dunn observed in 1897, "I have seen America spread out from the Atlantic to the Pacific, with a branch office of the Standard Oil Company in every hamlet." Between 1898 and 1902, 198 trusts or giant new corporations were created in coal, sugar, and other industries, prompting a growing backlash. At a Chicago antitrust conference in 1898, William Jennings Bryan drew roars from the faithful when he shouted, "One of the great purposes of government is to put rings in the noses of hogs." The McKinley administration, true to its promises, stood guard over the new corporate giants. The merger wave conferred a new centrality on Wall Street investment houses, for the capital needs of the new trusts dwarfed the resources of small-town banks and private individuals. Only the prestigious Wall Street firms, such as J.P. Morgan & Company or Kuhn Loeb, could tap the foreign and domestic capital needed to execute these transactions. Switching their focus from railroad bonds to industrial securities, they forged the new trusts, issued their stock, tucked away shares for themselves, and handpicked their executives. However much reformers deplored the trusts, they excited many investors, who absorbed wave after wave of new issues sponsored by Wall Street. While many Americans quaked before these giant new concerns, many others were trying to figure out how to profit from them. When J.P. Morgan decided to create a steel trust in late 1900, he knew he would have to tangle with two men who were confirmed cynics about Wall Street: Carnegie, master of the steel mills, and Rockefeller, king of the iron ore. Morgan was worried that Carnegie would diversify into finished steel products and threaten his recently launched Federal Steel Company, while Carnegie feared a reverse maneuver by Morgan. Meanwhile, Carnegie and Morgan were both alarmed by reports that Rockefeller might diversify into steel mills. To avert overbuilding and internecine price wars, Morgan decided to spearhead a new steel consolidation. Morgan was not thrilled about catering to Rockefeller, who had flouted Wall Street by financing his trust from retained earnings and holding cash reserves equal to those of many banks. He was also well aware of William Rockefeller's intimacy with James Stillman of National City Bank. When Morgan contemplated a merger with the London House of Barings in 1904, his counterpart, Lord Revelstoke, reported afterward to a partner that Morgan inveighed bitterly against the growing power of the Jews and of the Rockefeller crowd, and said more than once that our firm and his were the only two composed of white men in New York. In many respects, Rockefeller and Morgan were antithetical types, offering a vivid contrast between the ascetic and the sybarite, the roundhead and the cavalier. As the chieftain of the Anglo-American financial establishment, the well-born Morgan, expensively educated in America and Europe, was a consummate insider in the business world. For more than 40 years, he had been the chief conduit for British capital that had financed American railroads and industry. Blustery and theatrical, Morgan was impetuous and hot-blooded, cursed with a short attention span. At his headquarters at 23 Wall Street, he often seemed harried, ruling by brilliant snap judgments. Fond of luxury, Morgan inhabited the world of the ultra-rich, with their gargantuan cigars, fine port, and oversized steam yachts. For Rockefeller, Morgan embodied all the sins of pride, luxury, and arrogance. When they first met at William Rockefeller's Hudson River mansion, they took an instant dislike to each other. "We had a few pleasant words," noted Rockefeller, "but I could see that Mr. Morgan was very much, well, like Mr. Morgan. Very haughty, very inclined to look down on other men. I looked at him. For my part, I have never been able to see why any man should have such a high and mighty feeling about himself." For Morgan, Rockefeller was too dry and prudish, devoid of manly charms and vices. And how could he not grumble at the effrontery of someone who had created a cartel without him? Nevertheless, both men detested competition as a destructive force, a dangerously antiquated notion. For years, Morgan had arbitrated disputes among railroad presidents, helping them to carve up territories, and his formation of industrial trusts constituted a logical progression in his career. When Judge Elbert H. Gary informed Morgan in early 1901 that Rockefeller's Mesabi interests had to form part of any steel cartel, Morgan balked. "We have got all we can attend to," he told Gary. When Gary persisted, Morgan glumly agreed that they had to incorporate Lake Superior Consolidated Iron Mines and Bessemer Steamship into U.S. Steel. "How are we going to get them?" he asked. "You are going to talk to Mr. Rockefeller," said Gary. "I would not think of it," said Morgan. "Why?" "I don't like him." "Mr. Morgan," Gary retorted, "when a business proposition of so great importance to the steel corporation is involved, would you let a personal prejudice interfere with your success?" "I don't know," said Morgan. In all likelihood, Morgan's attitude was a mixture of haughtiness and cowardice, for Rockefeller was one of the few people he could not intimidate. In an act of considerable self-mortification, Morgan asked Rockefeller if he could see him at 26 Broadway. Explaining that he was retired and never went to the office, Rockefeller said he would be happy to receive him at West 54th Street. Rockefeller knew the bargaining edge of the last-minute holdout and enjoyed tweaking Wall Street's foremost banker. Soon after he arrived at Rockefeller's house, Morgan gruffly asked the price of the ore properties. Rockefeller threw up his hands in mock despair, reminded Morgan that he was retired, and told him to discuss the deal with his 27-year-old son, who would undoubtedly be glad to talk with him. This was a blatant affront, but the banker grudgingly said that Junior should call at his office at Broad and Wall Streets. Relishing their little game, Senior and Junior stalled in arranging the meeting and very nearly overplayed their hand. Then, on the morning of February 25th, 1901, Henry Rogers stopped by Junior's desk and inquired, "Would you like to go with me to meet Mr. Morgan?" Sensing that the time had come to put Morgan out of his misery, Junior accompanied Rogers that afternoon. Now it was Morgan's turn to behave in a condescending manner. When Rogers and Junior entered his office, he was consulting with his partner Charles Steele and did not look up from his desk. When Steele left, Morgan finally lifted his eyes, and Rogers introduced Junior. Morgan complained about the delay and said matters had to be wrapped up within 24 hours. Junior explained that it had taken time to appraise the properties. "Well," Morgan barked, glowering at Junior, "what's your price?" If Morgan thought he was dealing with a choir boy, he was soon undeceived. Showing an unexpected pluck that nobody, not even Junior, knew was there, he shot back, "Mr. Morgan, I think there must be some mistake. I did not come here to sell. I understood you wished to buy." he asked Morgan to name a price that his father might accept or decline. For Junior, it must have been a revelatory moment. He was sparring with Wall Street's potentate. When Morgan stepped out briefly, Henry Rogers, flabbergasted, advised Junior to soften his tone. But Junior said he meant every word, and that he and Father were absolutely indifferent about coming into the consolidation. The tense standoff ended in a compromise. Morgan and Junior agreed that Henry Clay Frick would serve as an honest broker to establish a mutually agreeable price. As Junior was leaving, he asked Morgan whether his father might take a share in the steel syndication. Taking another jab, Morgan replied that the offering was oversubscribed and that he had delayed too long in submitting his request. Since Morgan had already set aside $5 million allotments for William Rockefeller and James Stillman, he must have known that John D. would be stung by this exclusion. When Junior returned to 26 Broadway, he immediately wrote to his parents, describing Morgan's brusqueness and his response. The whole thing suggested the final sweep-up of the room, and we seemed to be the crumbs around the edge which of course must be swept up and expect to be swept up, and which it was most annoying to find at this late date still on the floor. His parents were overjoyed that Junior had stood up to Morgan. His father, reading the letter aloud to Setti, paused every few sentences to exclaim, "Great Caesar, but John is a trump!" Setti, every inch the Spartan mother, was no less amazed. "Indeed, you were masterly in the conduct of the negotiation," she wrote back. "And you are so quiet and unassuming in both words and manner. Control of self wins the battle, for it means control of others." The ecstatic response of Junior's parents perhaps hints at relief from unspoken doubts, as if both had wondered whether he could meet the demands imposed by the family fortune. After the meeting, Morgan urged Frick to visit Rockefeller at his Pocantico estate. To avoid publicity, Frick took a carriage up after dark, and the coachman waited at the front gate while Frick and Rockefeller huddled behind some shrubbery. "Wouldn't it have made quite a story for the newspapers? Are skulking around in the bushes in the dark," Rockefeller later mused. As usual, he was wary and distant, not tipping his hand. "As my son told Mr. Morgan, I am not anxious to sell my own properties. But as you surmise, I never wish to stand in the way of a worthy enterprise. I do frankly object, however, to a prospective purchaser arbitrarily fixing an outside figure, and I cannot deal on such a basis." When Frick finally told him that Judge Gary's figure for Rockefeller's ore properties was $5 million below its true value, Rockefeller said curtly, "Then I will trust you to represent me." With his usual minimalist art, Rockefeller had concluded this epical meeting in about 15 minutes. On February 28th, when Gates and Jr. sat down with Frick at 26 Broadway, they maintained the party line that Rockefeller was not eager to sell. Just 2 weeks later, Rockefeller's papers show a startling development that altered the course of the negotiations. Gates had commissioned new maps of potential ore deposits along the Mesabi Range that disclosed for the first time the likely existence of undiscovered mines. As Junior interpreted this catastrophic news to his father, "We had supposed up to date that we now controlled practically all of the ore reserve of the range. In view of this new map, the information of which is known only to ourselves, we are more inclined to make some trade." After this, the Rockefellers subtly softened their negotiating posture, aided by a rapport between Junior and Frick so strong that Junior was later made an executor of Frick's estate. "I have met no one in business whom I have been more strongly drawn to and have greater confidence in than Mr. Frick," Junior told his father in mid-March. The talks were also assisted by Rockefeller's declared resolve not to extract the last penny, so as to leave a favorable and friendly impression on Mr. Morgan, as Junior put it. For all that, Rockefeller reaped a fantastic profit in the creation of U.S. Steel, the first billion-dollar corporation and the first trust to overtake Standard Oil in size. The consolidated stock, originally bought for $10 a share in 1893, now fetched the equivalent of $160 in cash in 1901. Gates and Jr. made an agreement with Frick that the Rockefellers would receive $80 million for the consolidated stock, half in the form of U.S. Steel common stock and half in preferred, and another $8.5 million for the 56 Lake vessels of the Bessemer fleet. Gates estimated that $55 million of the $88.5 million was clear profit. The U.S. Steel deal swelled Rockefeller's net worth beyond $200 million, $3.5 billion today, and made him the second richest man in America. On the other hand, he fell further behind Andrew Carnegie, who had received $300 million in bonds as his portion for the sale of Carnegie Steel. But this moment marked the zenith of Carnegie's wealth, whereas Rockefeller was just warming up. Having overseen the Mesabi operation, Gates was not shy about demanding his due. When he delivered an oral report on the $55 million profit, Rockefeller saluted his effort and murmured quietly, "Thank you, Mr. Gates, thank you." Gates fixed Rockefeller with a steady, quizzical look. For a long time he had shown an almost filial deference toward his boss, but now he was well aware of his worth. Seizing the moment, he had the courage to say, "Thank you is not enough, Mr. Rockefeller." Forced to reconsider, Rockefeller evidently came up with a large enough bonus, although Gates never revealed the exact amount. Notwithstanding his veneration of his mentor, Gates griped for years about his compensation and sometimes stooped to nasty jokes about Rockefeller's avarice. For a time, it seemed that the Steel Trust might effect a rapprochement between Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan. One of the largest U.S. steel stockholders, Rockefeller demanded and won board seats for himself and his son. Yet financial differences quickly soured his relations with Morgan. Rockefeller was upset by U.S. Steel's extravagant dividends, even though he was a major recipient. In 1904, to register his protest, he resigned from the board, never having attended a meeting, and left Junior behind to represent him. By 1911, the Rockefellers liquidated the last of their U.S. Steel holdings. During the next 2 years, Morgan enjoyed an unspoken revenge by continuing to assign Rockefeller inferior positions in the weaker bond syndicates while excluding him from the sounder issues. Gates was always mystified by Morgan's success. "He seems to be a man incapable of calm and reasoning reflection, the victim of a succession of unreasoning impulses." Before leaving Rockefeller's exploits in the realm of iron ore, we should mark a prominent casualty of this adventure, his already troubled relationship with brother Frank. During the 1890s, Frank remained a vice president of Standard Oil of Ohio and took home a generous salary, despite his extended absences from Cleveland and a scornful indifference to business. As irascible as ever, he wrote testy letters to Standard Oil colleagues, forcing John and William to mediate. Frank was devoured by bitterness and often lapsed into violent, ungovernable rages that were aggravated by his alcoholism. Frank could never curb his compulsive gambling. Wanting to emulate the big killings of his brothers, he was tempted again and again into foolhardy ventures. With the best intentions, John fed Frank's gambling addiction, even though Frank often did not realize the source of the loans. John and William continued to carry a $180,000 mortgage on his Kansas ranch and bailed him out when his crops failed in 1893. This generosity only highlighted Frank's chronic dependency and further embittered him. In extending loans to Frank, John followed his usual strict accounting rules, which he always applied in a compulsive, inflexible fashion. Nevertheless, when it suited his convenience, Frank was offended by his brother's refusal to compromise on his business principles. Frank's best friend at the time was a bluff Irishman named James Corrigan. They hunted together, maintained adjoining estates in Ohio, and often invested together. A handsome man with a heavy jaw and bull neck, Corrigan was a popular, pugnacious Cleveland businessman. In the early 1880s, he had sold several refineries to John D., who had given him his first job, and counted him as a friend. As payment for one refinery, Rockefeller gave Corrigan 2,500 shares of Standard Oil. With this money, Corrigan bought a half-interest in the Franklin Iron Mining Company in the Lake Superior region of Wisconsin, the investment that first piqued Rockefeller's interest in the Mesabi Range. John loaned Frank the money to purchase the other half, keeping the mining stock as collateral. Not without reason, John D. later ruefully stated, "Neither my brother nor Corrigan had any reason to complain of my conduct. I made James Corrigan his fortune. I made my brother his fortune." When the 1893 panic struck, John D. behaved in exemplary fashion. He and William agreed to cancel their mortgage on Frank's Kansas ranch. Corrigan, meanwhile, took more loans from John D., secured by his Standard Oil stock, bringing the total to more than $400,000. Frank ran up debts to his brother in excess of $800,000, or $13 million in contemporary dollars. By these actions, John D. acquired considerable power over the two men, for he had retained as collateral their Franklin mining stock, Corrigan's Standard Oil shares, and Corrigan's share in a lake shipping fleet. As the panic deepened, Rockefeller refused to release collateral despite Corrigan's pleas that he could use his lake vessels to raise additional money. In October 1894, Corrigan tried to borrow another $150,000 from John without posting extra collateral. George Rogers tersely informed Corrigan that Mr. Rockefeller had advanced all he ought to on the Franklin mine property, and that unless he could offer some further collateral, I felt very sure Mr. Rockefeller would not help him out. When Corrigan stopped making interest payments altogether, Rockefeller carried him for another year before calling the loan. He offered to pay Corrigan $168 or $169 per share for his 2,500 shares of Standard Oil, which would yield enough to retire his $400,000 in debt. To gauge the value of this stock, Corrigan's attorney asked Rockefeller to provide detailed information about the trust's stocks, assets, investments, and earnings during the previous 5 years. Rockefeller refused to publicize such sensitive information. "The securities to which you refer have a well-known market value, which is published in the newspapers every day," Rockefeller told the attorney. At the time, few companies published annual reports. Yet Frank interpreted his brother's behavior in darkly conspiratorial terms. Several years later, he told Ida Tarbell that when he met with him to plead for more time for Corrigan, John said, "Frank, persuade Corrigan to sell me his Standard Oil stock. He is in a tight place. He can never get out, and I might as well have the stock as anybody." Frank took this to mean that John was bent upon destroying Corrigan to obtain his Standard Oil stock, and Frank advised his friend not to sell under any circumstances. Corrigan finally sold his Standard Oil stock to John D. at $168 a share in February 1895. Rockefeller paid the market price, roughly equivalent to what he paid his Standard colleagues for their stock that month. One Standard executive, Joseph Seep, said that Rockefeller did not even keep Corrigan's stock, but distributed it among his colleagues. Nevertheless, before a month had elapsed, the stock zoomed to $185 and then much higher. Instead of blaming bad luck, Corrigan decided he had been swindled, and in April 1895 wrote Rockefeller to that effect. When he received the letter, Rockefeller was stunned. "Is it possible that Jim Corrigan should be willing to write me such a letter?" he wrote back. "After my uniform kindness to him for a lifetime?" Some years later, possibly with the Corrigan affair in mind, Rockefeller lectured his son, "John, never lend money to your friends. It will spoil your friendships." Rockefeller had been neither Santa Claus nor Scrooge, but simply a hard, unsentimental lender. It is true that he had more than enough collateral to cover Corrigan's $400,000 in loans, but he had exercised patience and carried Corrigan for a year after payments ceased. Gates even complained that Rockefeller was coddling him. Corrigan waited until July 1897 before filing suit, saying it had taken that long to serve a subpoena on Rockefeller. The delay was more likely due to the continuing rise in Standard Oil stock, which had jumped to nearly $350 a share because of Archbold's generous dividend policy. Corrigan issued an ultimatum. Rockefeller could either give back his Standard shares or pay him $500 a share. The court-appointed arbitrators in the case, given rare access to Standard Oil's confidential books, decided that Rockefeller's conduct had been blameless. Even though Frank hotly insisted that John had cheated his best friend, he continued to touch his brother for money and a year later borrowed another $130,000. Still unaware of the true depth of Frank's bile, John jotted down a memo for his files in February 1896, saying of Frank, "He is all very nice and pleasant and I think appreciates that I am doing things for him." After the Corrigan case, Frank began to seem deranged on the subject of his brother. He began to materialize at 26 Broadway or on the broad veranda at Forest Hill, boisterously demanding to see him. Because of the pending Corrigan suit, John would receive him only with a secretary present to record what he said. In 1898, John told William that Frank was now threatening him and asked him to intercede. John then had some long talks with a drunken Frank who made extremely abusive remarks about him. Frank felt that his brother was so rich that he should forgive all his loans. When John differed, the breach between them widened. During their last meeting, as they walked down the street together, John said to him, "Frank, I'll always be a brother to you." They never spoke to or set eyes on each other again. Nursing an obsessive resentment, Frank decided to make a symbolic break with his brother. When John erected the towering obelisk at the family plot in Cleveland's Lakeview Cemetery in 1898, Frank had the caskets of his two children who had died in childhood disinterred from the family plot and transferred to another part of the cemetery. "Not one of my blood," he declared, "will ever rest upon land controlled by that monster, John D. Rockefeller." Soon thereafter, Frank, his wife, and three daughters withdrew from the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. Even after these unforgivable insults, John let Frank represent him on several corporate boards. While Frank's salary was reduced from $15,000 to $10,000 for his sinecure at Standard Oil of Ohio, he continued to draw this largely unearned salary until 1912. In September 1901, his finances ravaged by speculation, Frank told William that he would file for bankruptcy if he did not receive an immediate cash infusion of $86,000. When William secretly asked John to contribute half the amount, John wrote to him, "I will take half of the $86,000 if you take the other half, but Frank must not know that I am loaning the money." In 1907, John and William again saved Frank from bankruptcy by guaranteeing loans that Frank had gotten from his stockbroker. After the Corrigan business, Frank no longer felt any need to muzzle himself. Reporters soon learned that to get an inflammatory quote about John D., they simply had to contact Frank Rockefeller. Discussing the Corrigan affair, Frank told one reporter, "That treacherous act was but a detail in my brother's long record of heartless villainy. He never seems to get enough. I wonder where it would end, this desire of his for more millions." John never commented publicly on these diatribes. Unfortunately for John's reputation, Frank began to spew forth this invective just as the muckraking era got underway. Coming from a brother, these highly quotable remarks made a tremendous impression upon the public, who never dreamed that John D.'s treatment of Frank was one area of his life where his record was spotless. Chapter 21. The Enthusiast. When Rockefeller receded from the business world in the mid-1890s, the average American was earning less than $10 per week. Rockefeller's average income, a stupefying $10 million per annum in those glory days before income taxes, defied public comprehension. Of more than $250 million in dividends distributed by Standard Oil between 1893 and 1901, over a quarter went straight into Rockefeller's coffers. As Standard Oil shares took flight in the late 1890s, one periodical computed that Rockefeller's wealth had appreciated by $55 million, $972 million today, in 9 months. Where in the history of the world did any man ever make $55 million in 9 months? The editorialist demanded. Rockefeller was becoming Mr. Moneybags, a byword for wealth. One might have thought Rockefeller would relax in retirement, but he was still a prisoner to the Protestant work ethic and attacked recreational interests with the same intensity that he had brought to business. "I have not had the experience of the majority of businessmen," he later told William O. Inglis, "who find time hanging heavily on their hands." Yet his retirement was equally remarkable for its omissions. For instance, he lacked the wanderlust that infected other rich men, such as J.P. Morgan, in their later years. He never collected art or exploited his wealth to broaden his connections or cultivate fancy people. Aside from the occasional courtesy call from other moguls, he hobnobbed with the same family members, old friends, and Baptist clergy who had always formed his social circle. He showed no interest in old money clubs, parties, or organizations. Commenting on this, Ida Tarbell branded Rockefeller a social cripple and detected an inferiority complex that made him afraid to venture beyond his home turf. But his behavior actually connoted mental health. When someone expressed surprise to Rockefeller that he had not gotten a big head, he replied, "Only fools get swelled up over money." Comfortable with himself, he needed no outward validation of what he had accomplished. We can criticize him for lack of imagination, but not for weakness. It is striking that Rockefeller, so grave in business, was extremely fond of games in retirement and indulged in a little skylarking. As his body aged, his mind grew younger and more buoyant. Having missed a carefree boyhood, he seemed to want to compensate in his later years, and he suddenly showed a lot of his father's jollity. In the 1890s, Cleveland was seized by a bicycle craze, and the wheel season was opened each spring by hundreds of colorful tandem bikes gliding down Euclid Avenue. Though in his 50s, Rockefeller joined the fad with boyish elan. A firm believer in appropriate dress, he bought, in assorted shades, sporty riding costumes of corded knickerbocker suits, alpine hats, and cloth leggings. Frederick Gates was at Forest Hill when Rockefeller learned to ride, and he watched Rockefeller teach himself to turn around without alighting. He would start in with a wide circle, Gates recalled, and then follow it round and round each time, narrowing the circuit, until without dismounting he was almost circling the rear wheel. As with industrial methods, Rockefeller broke down cycling into its component parts, then perfected each movement. Much in the spirit of Big Bill, he liked to perform stunts on the bike, often jumping onto the seat as someone held the bike or holding open an umbrella as he rode with no hands. Through his interest in bike riding, Rockefeller came to master the fundamentals of civil engineering, a subject that had long intrigued him. When he wanted to ride his bike up the steep slope to the Forest Hill house, an engineer told him that no practicable grade could be found. "Nothing is impossible," Rockefeller replied. Burying himself in civil engineering books, he figured out a suitable angle, a 3% grade in engineering lingo, and, true to his prediction, rode his bike straight up to the door. Rockefeller proved fatally susceptible to another fad, golf. In 1899, he was staying at a hotel in Lakewood, New Jersey, and pitching horseshoes with a friend, Elias Johnson, who praised his easy style and nearly unbeatable game. Johnson tried to persuade Rockefeller that these skills would serve him well in golf. "He would look me through with those calm blue-gray eyes, but say nothing," said Johnson. Finally, he convinced Rockefeller to try a few swings on a grassy, secluded spot near their hotel. After a few tips, Johnson later recalled in an interview, Rockefeller drove 3 balls more than 100 yards apiece. "Is that all there is of it?" Rockefeller asked. "Yes, that's all there is of it, but not 1 in 100 would do the same thing you've done just now. They want to do too much." His competitive urges surfacing, Rockefeller said, "Do not some players send the ball farther than that?" "Yes, but long shots come only after much practice." Rockefeller decided to play a little prank on his wife. He had a golf pro, Joe Mitchell, come to the hotel and give him lessons on the sly. Every time the caddies saw Seti approaching, Rockefeller scampered for cover in the bushes. Several weeks later, he said to her offhandedly that golf seemed like a very nice sport and that he might take a shot at it. He then stepped up to a tee and smacked the ball 160 yards straight down the fairway. After marveling for a moment, Seti shook her head and said, "John, I might have known it. You do things better and more easily than anyone else." On April 2, 1899, right before his 60th birthday, Rockefeller played his first complete game of golf, finishing 9 holes in 64 strokes. After this, he took up the sport with a vengeance. Not always a powerful player, he was nonetheless eerily accurate, his swing so exacting that time seemed suspended. "It was the slowest backswing I ever saw," said one partner. "It seemed to last for minutes." Once again, Rockefeller dissected his game like a manufacturing method. Noticing that he twisted his right foot at the end of his stroke, he had his caddy nail his foot into the ground with a wire croquet wicket, a hazardous trick that he abandoned once the fault was corrected. Since he lifted his head as he shot, he hired a boy to say, "Keep your head down," whenever he teed off. Rockefeller was frustrated at one point when he kept slicing his woods. To identify the source of the problem, he commissioned a Cleveland photographer to do snapshots of his swing, a time and motion study that enabled him to root out the troublesome flaw. Later, he had movies made of his game, which he studied intently. As part of this studious approach, he recorded all his golf scores in thick little books, with names, dates, and places included. Rockefeller's passion for golf was linked to his medical problems of the 1890s, which turned him into a fitness buff. "Played in moderation, golf is not only a fascinating game, but a valuable aid to health," he advised friends. His physician and frequent golf partner, Dr. Hamilton Bigger, credited golf with rejuvenating Rockefeller after his near breakdown. "Since he has taken it up with such gusto, there has been a marked change in his appearance," he told a reporter. "His skin, which was formerly pallid and wrinkled, is now firm and ruddy and healthy." In later years, Rockefeller gave up walking and bicycled from hole to hole to conserve energy for the game. As an old man, he sat upright on the bike and had it pushed along by his caddy to economize further on his strength. Nothing could keep him from his morning game. If it rained or the sun was too strong, a caddy shielded him with a big black umbrella throughout. His retinue came equipped with rubbers for muddy weather, sweaters for chilly weather, and towels to dry the clubs in a drizzle. Golf made Rockefeller a more gregarious person, bringing out a bonhomie that had been stifled during the Standard Oil years. For a man who shrank from intimate discussion, golf provided an ideal way to socialize in a highly structured, risk-free environment from 10:15 to 12 each morning. As soon as he arrived, he would clown around, setting a tone of genial banter, and people responded in kind. He hummed hymns or popular songs, told humorous anecdotes, or even read short poems of his own composition. One of his favorite gags involved an eminent minister who liked to cheat at golf. An adroit mimic, Rockefeller aped the divine, giving the ball a secret little kick behind a tree stump. Golf brought out a native drollery that he had never allowed to flower before. "We should not rejoice in the downfall of others," he wrote his daughter Bessie. "But I slaughtered 4 men at golf on Saturday last. This was very wrong, and of course I will never do it again." Rockefeller established various taboos on the course, including that no business or charitable bequests should ever be discussed. People who flouted these rules were never invited back, and Rockefeller was extremely uncompromising on the subject. He wanted to keep things on a superficial, slightly unreal level, and ward off any serious discussion. In this way, he could be with people, yet surrounded by his own ring of silence, an isolated figure amid the crowd, setting the terms of social intercourse. Despite his unmatched place in America's urban and industrial growth, Rockefeller remained a country boy at heart and now receded further from the city. Perhaps as a legacy of his upstate boyhood, he was drawn to hilltop houses with spacious water views. Seeking an escape from Manhattan, he was especially attracted to the Hudson River, on which William had built his 1,000-acre manor. John Dee was moved by the river's beauty and majestic shoreline, flanked by rolling farmland and picturesque villages. When land prices plunged during the 1893 panic, he bought 400 acres in the Pocantico Hills of North Tarrytown, just south of Rockwood Hall. Though he considered establishing a weekend house or summer hideaway, he had no exact plan. "As I stated to you before coming," he wrote to Setti in early September 1893, "I have no scheme whatever in reference to this new property on the Hudson, further than to own it and let the future determine how we wish to use it." Rockefeller was drawn to the spot by natural beauty, not elegant neighbors. He chose the site of his house on Pocantico Hills for its glorious view of the Hudson and the Catskills, one of the most magnificent landscapes in America, reported Gates, who accompanied him on the first trip. The property included a jagged ridge called Kiket Hill, derived from the Dutch word for lookout, which enjoyed splendid views of the river and distant palisades. As at Forest Hill, Rockefeller simply took the furnished house that came with the property, a modest frame structure with wide verandas, known as the Parsons.